Well, let me again say thank you to the church here for the invite to come and speak, not just on behalf of the Foster's Home, but likewise on behalf of religion and in the kingdom of God. We're all in this thing together, regardless of what our ministries may be, and I'm of the persuasion that we are all in some way, shape, form, or fashion ministers, and that we can all have our own niche, and that's the greatest thing about being in the kingdom, is that God can use us where we are for his purposes. And so I'm thankful for the invite. I'm thankful for what this church has done for, I need to stay close to that.
Got an echo.
Okay, gotcha. So I'm thankful for what this church has done for Foster's Home, and I could tell when I got here and saw the slide scrolling that this church is obviously involved in a myriad of different ministries. And that says something about you. It seemed like a lot of them were maybe from afar. I'm sure that you have ministries here locally that you are plugged into and that you're engaged in. And that too says a lot about you. If you've spent any time and grown up like I have in Churches of Christ, and even sometimes it's a little bit shocking. I had a few moments in my life where I probably leaned on the side of those who were of the conviction that it was not good for a children's home to give money, or excuse me, for a church to give money directly to a children's home. Of course, there are people of all sorts of persuasions and have a lot of different ideas about those types of things. But being familiar with that means that I'm familiar with the language that most of us have grown up hearing when we talk about our churches supporting a children's home or our churches supporting a particular ministry. We all know what we mean, right? Most often, it is associated solely with some type of monetary assistance. And there's nothing wrong with that. It is a great way of describing what it means. We all know that's what is meant. And then there will be those who will go, but we believe that in more than just that, we want to be plugged in. We want to be involved. And so we have people come and present. Or maybe churches will often send a youth group or send a group of individuals from their church to that particular children's home or to that mission work to be involved, because you know that you want to be more than just sending a check, right? That's important. That's what makes for partnerships. And of course, I'm really intentional about my words. If you were in Bible class, you heard me begin by talking about partnerships. And partnerships are important for us at Foster's Home because it says that we're in this thing together. Okay? And like Paul speaks of the church at Philippi, a church that helped him in his early work, and at one time was the only church that actually funded his work, Paul said he wanted the good that came from his work to go into their account. In Philippians 4, he goes, I want you to get the credit for it. I want it to go into your account, like interest in your account. Interesting way of putting it. Interesting way of putting it. But it shows how much he loved that church, and he wanted them to reap the benefit of his work. That's what partners do. They have an equal share in what they're trying to do, what they're trying to accomplish. And likewise, churches that partner with us, I want them to understand that that they get the glory and they get the honor for helping us do what we do. But they get the credit for it. They get the interest for it. And it's important to see that. Now, I'm gonna give you a challenge this morning, okay? And I got to be careful doing it because it's asking a lot of people. But I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to challenge you this morning to lay aside that very nebulous term of support for something better. I believe it's biblical, number one, and I believe it's also better just in terms of thought. And I've got the anecdotal evidence to prove it, okay? And it's not a term that you would expect, but if you're looking at the slide, you got to know it has to do with investing, okay? Investing. Now, how I'm going to make this case is a little tricky. I'm going to ask you to do and look at some other concepts and some other ideas and look at how Paul and Jesus both use this idea to make a case about life and what they were trying to accomplish. And I want to appeal to them, first with Paul, and I'm going to make a case that Paul probably got his terminology from Jesus in one of his parables, and you might be shocked what Jesus was saying. But that'll give you the biblical basis to say, I'm not going to use this term support anymore. I'm going to choose to use the word invest. Okay? So first, the biblical case. Biblical case. Paul in Galatians chapter 6 and verses 7 through 10 says, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. For whatsoever a man sows, that will he also reap. I'm going to pause for a second because if you were in Bible class, you know that I was supposed to be an ag teacher. Okay? And so livestock is my world, but any ag teacher is going to also have to study agronomy, okay? Agronomy. And agronomy is the study of crop science, right? Paul, and of course the Bible, Jesus did this, but in the Bible you find this agrarian terminology used throughout the scriptures to teach lessons, right? Jesus told a parable, it's called the parable of the sower. In fact, he said, hear the parable of the sower. And then he tells a story about a man who's casting seed here and there, and some falls on fertile ground, some falls on rocky ground, some falls on ground that gets the seeds never ever penetrate the ground and they get eaten up by the birds and whatever else. But he says, hear the parable of the sower. And he uses agrarian terminology. He uses agronomy for making this case because it's easy to understand. We can all understand it. Maybe it's at the level of large scale farming. Maybe it's at the level of your garden. But we can all understand that, okay? So Paul says, whatsoever a person sows, that will he also reap. If you sow to the Spirit, you will reap from the Spirit. If you sow to the flesh, you will reap from the flesh. And then he says this, at a due time, if you sow to the Spirit, you will reap a harvest. That's where you know he's talking about agronomy to make his point. In due time, if you don't lose heart, if you don't lose faith, you will reap a harvest. And you might have to work. You might have to sow. You're going to have to till. You're going to have to water. You're going to have to really engage this thing. But if you look at it through the lens of faith, God will provide a harvest. Of course, that's why he would say to his epistle, or in his epistle to Corinth, I planted, Apollos watered, but who gives the increase? God gives the increase. Okay? And then he finishes in verse 10 by saying, as we therefore have opportunity, let us do good to all men, but especially those of the household of faith. So you know he's using this agronomy illustration to make a point about life, right? It's about life. Now, farming, large-scale farming, is risky. It is, dare I say, a gamble. Okay? You are resting in circumstances beyond your control, right? Now, if you are a farmer, the reason you farm is because you can, if it all goes well, you can provide a very good means of providing for yourself, and you can lose it all. When Hurricane Harvey hit in 2017, I had some dear friends from just outside of Woodsboro, Texas, lost millions in cotton. Millions. Now, yes, they had crop insurance, and it didn't put them out of the farming business for good, but they took a hit. They took a big hit. It is a real gamble to farm. But when all goes well, it can pay in dividends, great harvest. But it's also risky. It's a gamble. And you got to be careful. And that's the way investing is, right? That's exactly the way investing is. Why do most of us invest in some way, whether it's in the stock market, maybe you take dilapidated homes and you buy them cheap and you fix them up and then you rent them out, or maybe you sell them, right? You're doing that. You're taking a seed, letting it germinate, grow into something better, and then you're trying to make a profit off of it, right? Even in the most conservative of investment strategies, you're still doing it for the benefit of the future, right? You're not investing for now. You're investing for the future, right? Yeah. Just like farming. It takes time. It takes a little bit of work and a lot of time, but you farm for the product that comes after germination, after that product produces a fruit of some sort, and then when you harvest it. Make sense? Okay, we can all understand that, right? And yet, Paul uses that as a means for teaching about life. So, where did he get it from? Well, here's where I want to make a case from Matthew chapter 25. I would contend he probably got this from Jesus. In Matthew 25, Jesus tells a series of parables, and one of those parables is called the parable of the talents. Okay? Now, a talent was a denomination of money. And if my understanding is correct, it was a pretty significant amount of money. A talent was 1 year's wages for a laborer. Pretty significant amount of money, a year's wages. I mean, it wouldn't be easy for any of us to necessarily go without work for 1 year, right? 1 year matters, okay? So this man in Jesus' story, this man's about to go off on a journey, and he decides to leave with three different employees, so to speak, three different amounts of money, three different amounts of talents. One, he gives five. To another, he gives two. And then to a third, he gives one. And then he leaves. Eventually, he comes back, and it's time for a reckoning, right? It's time for a reckoning of accounts. The one that he had given five talents to comes back. And what does he have for his boss? He has 10 talents, right? He has doubled what his boss had given him. And his boss says, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you a ruler over many. The one that he gives two talents to reports back. How many does he bring? He brings four. He too doubles what he had been given. Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you a ruler over many. And then comes the guy that he had given one talent to. Okay? And notice what Jesus says. This is verse 24 of Matthew 25. He also who had received the one talent came forward saying, now listen to this, okay? Master, I knew you to be a hard man. We might paraphrase that as saying, I knew you have high expectations. You're not the easiest guy to work for. You demand something from us. Now look at the next clause. Reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. Interesting way of phrasing it. Master, I knew you to be a hard man, that you reap where you do not sow and that you gather where no seed has been scattered. He said, so I was afraid and I went and hid your talent where? In the ground. Not under his bed. You know, not behind the refrigerator, not in the safe, not in the lockbox, in the ground. Why does he say buried it in the ground? Well, he's talking about reaping and sowing. He says, here, you have what is yours. So, let's note, it's not like he lost the talent. Okay? It's not like he tried to do something with it and then said, I lost it. I mean, it was a failed venture. I've got nothing to give you. So, he gives his boss what he had been given. And what did that do for him? His boss says, you wicked and slothful servant. Now, translations have changed over the years. Depending on the translation you have, this gets a little bit tricky. But, and especially in light of the Greek, because the Greek offers no punctuation marks, okay? The Greek offers no punctuation marks. The only way that we can determine punctuation in the English from the Greek is by reason of grammatical construct and context. In the ESV and in other more modern versions, they have Jesus or the boss in the parable asking a rhetorical question. The King James, the New King James, some other translations make this a statement. But they have a question being asked. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gathered where I scattered no seed? Question mark. Like, he said he knew this. That's the way he phrased his initial introduction of the conversation in the presentation of one talent. I knew you were a hard man. That you reap where you do not sow and that you harvest where you do not scatter seed. He goes, you knew that really? If that was the case, watch what he says. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming, I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him that was, and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has, will more be given, and he will have an abundance. But take from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness, in the place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, once again, this is not so much a story about farming. It is a story about life, right? And what you do with what God has given you, whether it is your gifts or your other type of talents, the talents we're more familiar with, like the gift of teaching or the gift of song or the gift of prayer or the gift of just human interaction or the gift of compassion, whatever your gift might be. Utilizing those gifts, do not squander them. You groom them, you cultivate them, you do something with them because God has given them to you for a purpose. Every single thing that God gives us can and should be used for his glory, right? Needs to be groomed. Now, Jesus uses the word or the idea of investing to make a point about life. And I think if it is good enough for Jesus, it ought to be good enough for me. Now, let's separate this from my world of children's homes and let's make it about something else. And this is where I want to make the case that it also is better for reasons beyond just this is a case that the Bible makes, that Jesus makes, and I think that Paul makes. Okay? So indulge me this. Let us suppose that there is a missionary couple from Tanzania. Tanzania, okay? And they walk through the doors, they come into the foyer, they come and they sit right back over here on a pew over here, and they are going to very quietly and patiently wait for me to shut up. And they are hoping that they can get the ear of the elders of the downtown Church of Christ in Midland, Texas, okay? They are here stateside for 3 months, okay? They have lost some support from their churches, and they are stateside for 3 months drumming up more support so that they can keep going on in their ministry. And because the elders here at the Downtown Church of Christ are gracious men, they are going to grant this couple 10, 15, 20 minutes after worship this morning, and they're going to hear about their work. And so after worship, they sit and they listen, and they hear about the conversions, they hear about the work that this couple has done for the last 10, 15 years. They hear about how they've lost their supporters in the last few years because churches are really struggling, and they want to make this case. Can you help us? Can you help support us? And let us suppose the elders of the Downtown Church of Christ tell this couple, here at the Downtown Church of Christ, we don't believe in supporting missionaries. We believe in investing in them. Question number one. Do you believe that a missionary has ever heard that type of language or had that type of language used to describe the support that they might be given from a church? I've asked a ton. Once again, I was in church work for about 15 years. I have never had a missionary tell me that an eldership or a group of church leaders that they've petitioned to help fund their work has ever called what they provide them an investment. But I've also asked those missionaries, would it matter at all if an eldership did? And I have had a number kind of scratch their head and go, well, it sure sounds different. It sure sounds inviting. And do you want to know why it sounds different and why it sounds inviting? Because psychologically, what that kind of statement does is say that you are looking at things through the lens of faith, and you believe that your seed planted in this individual's account is going to produce interest likened to an investment. It says you believe that those seeds being sown in the ground are going to produce a harvest. It says you believe in them. It says that you are instilling and showing and giving hope, dignity, but maybe most importantly, value to what they're doing. And I know just a couple of missionaries who would love to feel like they were valued, that there was dignity to their work, and that there was hope in what they were trying to accomplish. And I say that, whether it's a missionary scenario, whether it is your youth group, whether it is some endeavor that you're involved in here locally in Midland, every dime, every amount of energy is an investment in that work. And if you look at it through the lens of faith, you're saying you believe that God can multiply that and produce a harvest. It is an investment in the kingdom. It is an investment in hope. Every time I sign a receipt letter, whether it be from a church or whether it be from a donor, I am thinking this person is making an investment in the lives of kids from hard places. They are entrusting with us. They are believing that God can do through us something that will produce a harvest, something that will produce interest, something that will grow, something that will flourish. And I believe it gives me hope. And in a world where we often suffer from, we call it compassion fatigue, and the things that give me hope are the things that reflect a belief that people believe in us. And seeing the story, seeing the fruit, whether it's tomorrow or whether it's next week or whether it's next year, continues to give me hope. So I want to challenge you to set aside that term and say, at the Downtown Church of Christ in Midland, Texas, we are all about investing in the kingdom of God, and we believe that God will